The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting in our relationships section of Oprah Daily. Here's what to do when your BFF enters a new life stage without you. You're still single, and your bestie is having a baby. Here's how to cope with feeling left behind. This article is by Jennifer King Lindley. Our friendships thrive on routine and ritual. The inside jokes, the side-by-side yoga mats, the Sunday night House of the Dragon live chats. When we have been in a close friendship for a while, we get into a reassuring rhythm, says Miriam Kermayer, Ph.D., a clinical psychologist and friendship researcher. We develop standard practices. We speak a certain number of times a week or get together every weekend. There is a flow. But those reassuring rhythms can shatter when one of you announces a big life leap. Marriage, pregnancy, a promotion. The kids are launched and we're retiring to Portugal. Such news can bring a confusing whirl of emotions, especially if you are the one left behind. You are so happy for her, of course, but worry she will no longer have time for you. You may feel envious as she blazes ahead. You might feel abandoned, anticipating the loss of her company or attention, or feel guilty for being anything but thrilled for her, says Leah Avellino, a psychotherapist in New York City and the co-founder of the group support organization Spoke Circles. Even though she's a friendship coach, Madison Romney has herself struggled with her life path as diverged from a bestie's. I got married, was working full-time, and found out I was pregnant. Meanwhile, I had a close friend who was still footloose and traveling the world. She told me, I feel like I am falling behind. I am sad we're not going to have this experience together. So, how do you navigate these transitions if you're the one watching your pal forge ahead? Closeness does not mean sameness. It is how we negotiate these differences that matters, says Avellino. Here, advice from friendship experts on riding the waves of change. First, share in her joy. Your friend giddily shares that she got into her dream graduate program. Now is not the time to pepper her with worries about what this means for your standing coffee date. Friends can retreat when they don't feel supported or seen during important moments. I spend a lot of time in my coaching sessions talking about how to match the other person's energy, says Romney. You may feel wobbly, sure, but for this moment, mirror her reactions with gusto. If she is super excited, jump up and down along with her. Welcome every detail. Tell me all about it. Echo her words back. You seem so excited. Romney is not condoning toxic positivity, but points out that how you respond initially can set the energy around the whole situation. Notice what comes up for you. Friends act as mirrors to our own lives. Their changes can trigger something in us, says Avellino. If you feel unmoored by her news, pause and look inward, she suggests. What is her transition bringing up in me? Am I feeling sad or ashamed or jealous? That might be a sign you want something different for yourself, like a more satisfying job or a true life partner. If you can sit with these difficult feelings with curiosity and self-compassion, they can act as bright flares, revealing your own goals and values. Lend a hand. Uncertainty creates anxiety in friendships, says Anna Goldfarb, author of Modern Friendship. One way to ease jitters and learn firsthand about a friend's next chapter is to offer to help, whether packing up for a move or helping select a wedding caterer. One of the best things you can do to maintain a friendship is support your friend in her new roles and identities. I want to understand all of you, says Goldfarb. Why? Research has found that close friends who offer this kind of social identity support are much more likely to remain best friends years later. Share how you feel. We say it all the time in romantic relationships. Meaningful pause. We need to talk. Yet, we are much less likely to take this direct track with friends, says Avellino. I often have new mothers tell me, my single friends don't get it. And I ask, well, what have you said to them to help them get it? Blank stare. Friendships go through changes, yet we are not taught how to have a conversation about them, she says. If we're not bringing up our feelings and being vulnerable, we are not creating opportunities for authentic connection. Kiermaier recommends you be proactive, not reactive here. Rather than waiting for resentments to fester, start the conversation before a friend's transition begins. Share your fears and mixed feelings about this big change. State how much you adore her and value the friendship, and discuss how you can problem solve together to find ways to stay close. Create new routines. Sure, your weekend jog and catch up may be out the window once your friend's baby arrives. You need to intentionally create new rituals together, says Romney. Having a routine builds trust and gives you something dependable to look forward to without lots of extra planning. Brainstorm what is possible under the new reality. Maybe you agree on a walk before work every Wednesday, or a Costco trip once a month. It is not about meeting a specific benchmark, adds Kiermaier. You could see each a only few times a year and still feel incredibly close. It is about what feels good to both of you. When one of Kiermaier's friends was under a major time crunch, they adapted by sending each other chatty voice notes to keep up with each other's day-to-day. Expect some give and take. Of course, you want to be flexible and understanding as a friend who is leaping forward adjusts to her new normal. One friend's life circumstances meant she would be much less available for a while, says Goldfarb. I sat her down and said, we can't get together as much as we'd like right now. I totally understand. I want you to know that I'm not going anywhere. I could see her shoulders relax. That said, adds Avellino, it is a misconception that the less busy friend needs to do all the heavy lifting. If you have reached out a few times and your invitations have been declined, be direct. I notice you haven't been able to get together lately and I miss you. How about I wait for you to reach out with a plan that works for you? Grow from experience. The happy news is that big life changes can enrich a friendship, not derail it. That happened for Romney and her world-traveling bestie. She helped me throw my daughter's first birthday party, and now we're planning on taking a hiking trip together, she says. We both admitted to being a little jealous of the other's life. Our solution was, well, come on in and be part of it. We're going to Oprah's Insider section next. Oprah asks, who inspires you to be better? There's something really special about their symbiosis, their togetherness, and the way they energize one another. This article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hello, Insiders. I hope you all had a great week. A couple of weeks ago, I visited the author David Robleski and his wife, Kimberly, at their home in Colorado. Many of you know that David is the author of Familiaris, our latest book club pick. If you haven't started reading yet, I highly recommend you do so. It's an epic story of a family spanning generations full of humor, history, and heart. Visiting their home, I was blown away by the way David and Kimberly, who's also a writer, worked together. David wrote the book in sections, and after each one, he and Kimberly would edit it together. They edited the whole book this way, sitting side by side at her computer, reading aloud to each other, turning every sentence over and making it better. At the end of a good editing day, they told me, they felt high. Actually high from the process. That's how exhilarating it is. Now, I don't know many couples who work together who can say that. There's something really special about their symbiosis, their togetherness, and the way they energize one another. So I want to ask you, who in your work life sparks your creativity? Who pushes you to do better, aim higher? Maybe it's a colleague. Maybe you're lucky enough to be like David and Kimberly and it's your partner. Let me know in the comments below. Who is your work soulmate? Have a great Sunday, everyone, and go well. We're now in the work and money section. How one female entrepreneur built her business on generosity. April Uckadell knows a thing or two about reinvention with a career spanning four industries and a new venture that taps into all of them. Now she's turned her hand to the world of consulting with a community twist. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. Over the course of her working life, April Uckadell has transitioned seamlessly from sales and strategy in high-end fashion to tech to her role as CEO at a luxury beauty startup and, more recently, to entrepreneurship. "I don't really see these career shifts as pivots, because they all got me here," she says. "I think that's the beauty of age. You start to look back and realize, that's why I did that." Uckadell's 25 years in high fashion included a stint at Prada and 9 years at luxury fashion house Diane von Furstenberg, where, as executive vice president of global sales and strategy, she was part of the team responsible for the company's record revenue growth from $6 million to $300 million in just 7 years. Sensing that the digital revolution would soon render her traditional career path obsolete, she decided to pivot, transforming her fashion sales experience into a CBO role at digital shopping marketplace Spring. After 4 successful years at Spring, her family decided they wanted a change, swapping the East Coast for the West. In Los Angeles, she landed a role as CEO of beauty content and commerce company Violet Grey. With her marketplace building experience at Spring, she was drawn to the partnership the company was building with Amazon, a luxury top shelf. She found both compelling and groundbreaking. But the onset of the pandemic saw Uckadell finally dive headfirst into an idea that had been percolating for some time, a modern community consultancy agency called The Board. The idea was a simple one: to harness the creative and strategic power in the new gig economy, assembling bespoke dream teams for project work. After years of being tapped for free advice, she willingly gave away. This was a way for her peers to monetize their expertise, as well as share it more widely. "I've always been generous with my time, my knowledge, and my network," she says. "I've never bought into the scarcity mindset, as if sharing what and who you know somehow diminishes your power or opportunities." Bringing together top strategists, operators, and creatives from beauty, fashion, media, and technology, the agency brings exceptional expertise to brands, all while creating a game-changing community for free-thinking talent to share knowledge, resources, and networks. Looking back now over the past 10 years, I realize everything I'd done had brought me to this moment, she says. I was uniquely qualified to bring this hybrid community and agency to life. Finding her superpower. I was working as the chief brand officer of Spring, and over the course of 3 years, I ran around Manhattan and onboarded about 1,600 brands. In all of those conversations, people would start to tell me all their other challenges. Because I had previously been a senior executive in fashion for so many years, there was a kinship. I quickly realized just how siloed the industry was. Everybody building independently and not a lot of shared learnings happening. I'd be talking to a brand and they would be telling me about a challenge they'd had with platforming. And I just left a brand down the street who just did that. I started to connect the dots. It became my side hustle superpower. Networking, connecting, advising, and mentoring. Where the idea came from. By the time the pandemic hit, I was working as CEO of beauty brand Violet Grey. I left my role and I consulted in between various careers, very much in that mode of what do I want to do next. At the same time, I watched this mass exodus of talent from my peer group moving out of corporate into consulting. That really flooded the gig economy with incredible senior talent, many of whom I had known through my time at Spring. People who had been very high up at Estee Lauder, Goop, Condé Nast, Target, or H&M. I had an idea. Can I create a destination for top talent so that when a company is looking for help, we're their first phone call? I wanted it to be curated around very high integrity humans, great at what they do, but who wanted to work in a way that's very much about collaboration. A place where generosity and ambition are not mutually exclusive. I began to ask questions. How do I build Angie's List meets Tinder? How do I find someone who's done this and is willing to share their knowledge? And how do we make that transactional? The initial goal. My real goal was to build a community around allowing talent to thrive and to pay things forward in a way, but also to monetize this. I wanted to create a space where great people can all contribute to a vibrant tapestry of different disciplines and industries, because that's where we all really learn from each other. There's definitely ageism for women in business. There's this sense that you get aged out or you're not as relevant to a certain age. But that is far from the truth. Part of the goal was creating a destination where this talent is valued, where collective knowledge and energies elevate us all. First steps. The name The Board just came to me. As a leader or founder who wouldn't want access to the board of experts, I posted about it on social media and was shocked by the number of people who came to me and said, I think I need it. What is it? But I wasn't quite sure what it was at first. When you're an operator, you genuinely hold yourself to targets and a roadmap, but this was very open-ended. On building a business during the pandemic. Because the board was born during COVID, there was this real sense of grabbing the momentum now that Zoom was normalized. Technology changed everything. Location no longer mattered in terms of working collaboratively. That was the biggest game changer. I don't think it could have happened otherwise. We got to 30 members and the outreach kept coming. That's when I started to realize, okay, there's something bigger here. What she created. The board is a collective of top talent that functions as a community model, but has an agency component as well. It allows for members to monetize their networks in a unique way. Ultimately, what we're all looking for is access to more opportunities, but also shared learnings and shared resources that allow our independent practices to thrive. The hardest moment. realizing that I'm building a business that's 100% dependent on humans, and humans are 100% undependable. There can be a lot of chasing and hand-holding. I'm one person wearing 50 hats. It's a typical founder challenge of having a vision and a plan, but there's only so many hours in the day. Chicken and egg between what you can afford to do and what you want to do. The moment you thought this just might work. I did a town hall when we were moving to paid membership. It was really a challenge to decide to tell the community, hey, this is great, but now we're going to start to charge you to be here. It was hard to know the right way to frame that. When I laid out the roadmap, I did it in a way where I couldn't see anybody on Zoom. I just saw my own presentation on screen with no comments. When my 30-minute monologue ended, I just burst into tears. I had this idea that it might be done for. But my assistant called and said, "You're going to die when you see what's in the chat." There was so much gratitude for all the hard work I put in. That was really amazing to see, and I thought, okay, this has legs. The results. We now have 228 terrific team members and a wait list of about 400. We're mindfully bringing on small cohorts so that we make sure they're a fit for the community. The majority of our members are East Coast, West Coast, and then we're starting to expand to the UK. We continue to work with brands of all sizes, building out more and more partnerships. We have in-person get-togethers a couple of times a year in New York and LA. That's when you really see the power of the model come to life. People are blown away by the peers that are there and the fact that they're on the same wavelength. There's a kind of a collective exhale when you realize you're not alone on the journey. It's special to have a community where there is generosity and ambition, but also a transparency and vulnerability, things that are not normally celebrated or prioritized in a corporate environment. It's not tactical networking, just very open and honest. Quite frankly, it's liberating when you can just take the armor off and have real conversations. I think we're all really looking for that type of community. We're in the word of the week. Pebbling. Is forwarding memes, reels, and posts the new love language? This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Pebbling. We all have this person in our lives, the one who is constantly sending us goofy videos, feel-good posts, and how-to diagrams. And if you don't know that person, you probably are that person. Regardless of how you feel about receiving 30 DMs a day from this sharer, the act has a sweet name. It's called pebbling. The term derives from a surprising source, penguins. When one Gen 2 penguin is courting another, they bring their paramour small pebbles, one by one, that can be used to build a nest. Imagine that each rock is a little token of love. When your friends or family pebble you with memes and videos, it's the same thing. Now, you may not actually appreciate having to react or respond to each message. And by the way, it's okay not to, or to wait a few days. But at least recognize the sender's intentions. They know you well and want to give you a little boost. The social media age has wreaked a lot of havoc, but this is one benign takeaway. Share to your heart's content, friends. We're in culture and news. Everything you need to know about Kamala Harris's parents. Harris credits her mom with raising her to be a strong black woman. And this article is written by the editors. Vice President Kamala Harris has a supportive roster of family members by her side, from her husband, Douglas Emhoff, to her accomplished sister, Maya, and her stepchildren. The history-making politician has taken to social media over the years to share plenty about the loved ones she holds dear. Essential to her backstory is the biracial identity she inherited from her parents, Shyamala Gopalan and Donald Harris. Both immigrated to the United States from India and Jamaica, respectively, to pursue doctorate degrees at the University of California, Berkeley. My parents marched and shouted in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. It's because of them and the folks who also took to the streets to fight for justice that I am where I am, Harris wrote on Instagram in 2020. They laid the path for me as only the second black woman ever elected to the United States Senate. Of course, Harris soon became the first black woman to be vice president, too. Although Harris's parents eventually divorced in 1971, the two were an accomplished duo. After graduating, her mother went on to become a prominent cancer researcher, while her father remains a professor of economics emeritus at Stanford University. Here's what we know about the parents who helped shape Harris from a young age. Shyamala and Donald first met in Berkeley, California, and were active in the civil rights movement. They both immigrated to the United States to receive doctorate degrees at the University of California, Berkeley. The two met and fell in love at Berkeley while participating in the civil rights movement, Harris wrote in her autobiography, The Truths We Hold. Shyamala's marriage and her decision to stay in the United States were the ultimate acts of self-determination and love. They even took a young Harris to some of the marches. According to a 2004 Los Angeles Times piece about Harris, a favorite family story begins with Harris's parents pushing her in a stroller as they marched for civil rights, joining in the protest chants. After one march, Shyamala asked, "What do you want, Kamala?" The toddler replied, "Feedom." Donald Harris was born in Jamaica and shared that with his daughters as they were growing up. According to Harris's 2019 autobiography, Donald was born in Jamaica in 1938. And immigrated to the United States to get his doctorate degree from the University of California, Berkeley. He eventually became a naturalized United States citizen. After teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Donald joined the Stanford Department of Economics in 1972. He taught there until his retirement in 1998. In an essay Donald wrote for Jamaica Global Online, he explains how he tried to show his daughters their heritage through frequent visits to Jamaica and engaging life there in all its richness and complexity. They visited Orange Hill, an area where Donald spent his childhood. Upon reaching the top of a little hill that opened much of that terrain to our full view, Kamala, ever the adventurous and assertive one, suddenly broke from the pack and took off like a gazelle in Serengeti, leaping over rocks and shrubs and fallen branches in utter joy and unleashed curiosity to explore that same enticing terrain. Kamala Harris's mom was a prominent breast cancer researcher. My mother was a pioneering breast cancer researcher, so I grew up learning about the importance of screening and early detection, Harris wrote in an Instagram post during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Shyamala's work led to her many top research institutions, including the University of Illinois, the University of Wisconsin, the Department of Medicine at McGill University in Montreal, and Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. She made substantial contributions to the field of hormones and breast cancer, publishing her research in countless journals and receiving numerous honors, according to Shyamala's obituary. Shyamala was the daughter of an Indian diplomat and a women's rights activist. In a 2019 Instagram post, Harris wrote, "When I was a young girl visiting my grandparents in India, I joined my grandfather and his buddies on their morning walk along the beach as they would talk about the importance of fighting for democracy and civil rights. Those walks made me who I am today." In addition, Shyamala's mother, Rajam, was a role model to the young Harris daughters due to her work for women's rights. Kamala comes from a long line of kick-ass women, Shyamala told the Los Angeles Times in that same 2004 article. And she raised Harris and her sister as strong black women. My mother was very intentional about raising my sister Maya and me as strong black women, Harris noted on social media in 2020. She coupled her teachings of civic duty and fearlessness with actions, which included taking us on Thursday nights to Rainbow Sign, a black cultural center near our home. There we were always greeted with warm hugs and exposed to extraordinary people like Shirley Chisholm, Nina Simone, and Maya Angelou, who helped show us what we could become. Shyamala passed away in 2009. Reflecting on the day her mom was diagnosed with colon cancer, Harris wrote, "It was one of the worst days of my life." Despite receiving chemotherapy treatments, Shyamala passed away on February 11, 2009. After her death, Harris said, "Though I miss her every day, I carry her with me wherever I go. I think of the battles she fought, the values she taught me, her commitment to improve health care for us all. There is no title or honor on earth I'll treasure more than to say I am Shyamala Gopalan's Harris's daughter." Before her inauguration as vice president, Harris said in an interview with NPR, "I will be thinking about my mother who is looking down from heaven. I will be thinking about all of the people who are counting on us to lead and are counting on us to see them and to address their needs and the things that keep them up at night. And I'll be thinking about the fact that we have to hit the ground running immediately to support the people of our country, to support the children of our country, and to help get us out of the crisis that we're facing." This next article is in Culture and News, but also in the books section. To help you face the painful truth, try this. The author of the book Awakening and the new book You Don't Have to Do It Alone shares a fresh way to approach unwelcome changes in our lives. This article is by Mark Nepo. Let me start with a story from my journey with cancer almost 40 years ago. In my 30s, I nearly died from a rare form of lymphoma that appeared as a very large tumor in my skull and another tumor protruding in the eighth rib of my back. I had never been through anything this difficult or life-threatening. I was terrified at every turn. It was then that the Chinese poet from the Tang Dynasty, Tu Fu, visited me in a dream. Out of the yellow mist he arrived, his long beard in tow. We were on a healthy shore, and he sat cross-legged in the sand, scratching delicately with a branch, his slender head down. I crouched and put it to him. "How do I block the fear?" He kept scratching the sand as if he hadn't heard. I grew angry. "How do I block the fear?" He lifted his head and shrugged, branch waving above him. "How does a tree block the wind?" With that, he disappeared. I woke to realize that a tree doesn't block the wind. It lets it through. The only way to meet fear is to face it and let it through. Our culture instructs us to hide from our fear or to conquer it. But both life strategies put us at odds with truth and keep us from its inevitable lessons. Over the years, I have come to see all this differently. What if we are to cooperate with truth? The way a bird cooperates to glide with the wind, or a fish cooperates to swim with the current that carries it. What if we looked at what we're facing and said, "Though this is difficult, I'll do what truth asks of me. I'll let truth be my teacher." Cooperating with truth is letting fear move through us like wind through a tree. It also means accepting the guidance of truth, however it appears, even if it comes in a dream from a poet who has been dead for 1.500 years. We often reject resources because they don't look familiar. But I had never had cancer, and so I was being offered resources I had never seen. From where? By who? Doesn't matter. In the thick tangle of my cancer journey, I had to have several bone marrow samplings, which were utterly painful. My fear of this procedure became visceral. I didn't know how I could face another. Finally, on the eve of the next one, I sat alone in the soft light of my bedroom. I had nowhere else to go. I closed my eyes and began to cooperate with the difficult truth before me. This enabled me to glimpse the flow of life that started before my fear, and which would continue during the pain of the procedure, and on into the future beyond my fear and pain. I opened my eyes and could see that, difficult as this would be, the actual extracting of marrow from my hip would last only 30 seconds. I could envision life beyond this. The practice of surrender, of cooperating with what I had to face, enabled me to find a way through. We tend to think of surrender as giving up or resigning ourselves to an unwanted outcome. But surrender is really the practice of fine-tuning our will to work with what we're given. I no longer see surrender and cooperation as different paths. Rather, cooperating with truth is how we surrender. As meditation is comprised of the practice of breathing, surrender is comprised of the practice of cooperating with truth. I thought I was an open person, but facing death made me truly open. I began to welcome everything in order to stay alive, and I was blessed to be given some form of healing from everywhere and everyone. For instance, though I was raised Jewish, a devout Catholic woman gave me a rose petal that fell from the sky, which she believed had been dropped by Mother Mary in the Philippines. She had tucked it in a gold purse. It was so kind of her. Whether I believed that this actually happened or not wasn't a prerequisite to accepting her help. I simply bowed my head and uttered, "Thank you." And accepting miracles from all directions, wherever I could find them, led me to my own, which saved my life. The truth is that I was not, and am still not, wise enough to know what worked and what didn't. I was simply and profoundly called to believe in everything. Ever since, I have been a student of paths. Perhaps this has been my greatest cooperation with truth, to find what matters and what is healing wherever I can. And all my books and all the sacred chances to teach and list my devotion to the common center of all paths and the unique gifts of each. Once on the other side of my cancer journey, I realized that the things we suffer and the things we love provide us with an inner curriculum. When we least expect it, it is working with what we're given while staying close to what we love that is a constant teacher. And surviving cancer in my mid-30s only deepened my life of inquiry. By surrendering to the miracle of life in order to survive, my sense of listening and learning was transformed into an ongoing covenant of care. But my sense of surrender goes back to childhood. When 8 or 9, I fell in the schoolyard, skinning my arms and knees badly. While slightly bloodied on the ground, I was forced to be still on the earth for the first time. I gave in to where I was. I had never realized that this massive planet was holding us up. For the first time, I had experienced something larger than any of us. Putting ourselves in tune or rhythm with the greater forces of life is the true purpose of will. This task is at the heart of the ancient Chinese worldview known as the Tao, which simply means the way. These early seekers envisioned the greater forces of life as an invisible river and saw every soul as a fish born in that river. And so, the true purpose of all our efforts is to find the current so we can swim with it, so we can be carried along with the greater forces of life. in a spiritual sense, this is cooperating with truth as a way of life. This doesn't mean that we give up. Rather, such cooperation and alignment empowers and strengthens our gifts. It means that we can create more, repair more, hold more, and heal more. One more story from my life. During the heat of my cancer journey, when things seemed dire, my parents were unable to show up. This was very painful and broke our bond. It led to 15 years of estrangement. But when my father was turning 90, I ached to see him again. I reached out and we cried, and we made arrangements for me to visit. He hemmed and stalled, saying that after all this time, my mother didn't want me in the house. I was hurt and furious. This was the house I grew up in. The more I wrestled with this, the more I had to surrender to the truth of our unlikely reunion. Finally, cooperating with the harsh truth of it all, I entered a moment of grace that dilated my perspective, and I uttered out loud to no one, "Of course, why would it be any different?" I called my father and said, "I will meet you anywhere, anytime." And so I drove 300 miles to meet him in the driveway, where I kissed the neck of an old man teetering on his cane. Cooperating with the truth of our lives empowered me to make home wherever he and I might meet. Over time, I have come to see that since I was exiled from home most of my life, I have made the space in which I teach home. I have, in fact, made the world home. Now, in my 70s, I am happy to surrender the want to be great for the great chance to be. I have found that if devoted to being wholehearted and giving, we enter a holy sequence in which surrender lets us cooperate with truth, and cooperating with truth opens us to grace. I often think that effort is revelation in slow motion, and the reward for effort is that the complete surrender of our care allows us to enter the grace of life itself. Our ever-present call is to work for grace without intention, loving the work and cooperating with truth, however it appears. For each time we dare to surrender, our inner teacher stretches the way we take things in, and this deepens our resilience and faith in life. I leave you with this image of the ocean, for the ocean is a great teacher in how to cooperate with truth. If you watch the surf, each wave gathers, thinking it has done this by itself, when it has been lifted into being by the power of the deep. Then it rises and crests and crashes, giving its all, thinning till there is nothing left to give, at which time it is pulled back into the deep to do it all again. This is its glorious life, which hypnotizes us. We spend so much time trying to avoid this process when the thoroughness of it is the secret of resilience, the secret of surrender. I urge you, go and watch the surf wherever you can, and let it speak to you about how to live your life. There's a couple questions at the end of this article. Questions to walk with. In your journal, describe a time when you were asked to cooperate with truth. How difficult was this for you? How long did it take? How did this affect you? In conversation with a friend or loved one, discuss the ways you try to control life and the ways you try to align with life. How do you feel, and understand the difference? Over in culture and news, Joe Biden drops out of the 2024 presidential race, and he endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris as the person to replace him on the ticket. This article is by Rosa Sanchez. President Joe Biden has dropped out of the race. The United States President, 81, has given up his spot on the 2024 Democratic candidate for president, leaving the party with just weeks to formalize their new nominee. Biden's decision comes after he received overwhelming pressure from within his own Democratic Party fellow politicians, voters, and reputable news outlets to bow out of his re-election bid due to his age and seemingly declining health. Despite his initial hesitance to leave the race, the seasoned politician, former Delaware senator, and our 46th U.S. president ultimately gave in. After contracting COVID-19 earlier this week, Biden made his big announcement on social media. "My fellow Americans, over the past 3.5 years, we have made great progress as a nation," he began his statement. "Today, America has the strongest economy in the world. We've made historic investments in rebuilding our nation, in lowering prescription drug costs for seniors, and in expanding affordable health care to a record number of Americans. We've provided critical needed care to 1 million veterans exposed to toxic substances, passed the first gun safety law in 30 years, appointed the first African-American woman to the Supreme Court, and passed the most significant climate legislation in the history of the world. America has never been better positioned to lead than we are today. I know none of this could have been done without you, the American people. Together, we overcome a once-in-a-century pandemic and the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. We've protected and preserved our democracy, and we've revitalized and strengthened our alliances around the world. It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your president," he continued. "And while it has been my intention to seek re-election, I believe it is in the best interest of my party and the country for me to stand down and to focus solely on fulfilling my duties as president for the remainder of my term." Biden added that he would speak later in the week about his decision. "For now, let me express my deepest gratitude to all those who have worked so hard to see me re-elected. I want to thank Vice President Kamala Harris for being an extraordinary partner in all this work, and let me express my heartfelt appreciation to the American people for the faith and trust you have placed in me. I believe today what I always have, that there is nothing American can't do when we do it together. We just have to remember we are the United States of America," he concluded his statement. He followed up his letter with an endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris. He shared, "My fellow Democrats, I have decided not to accept the nomination and to focus all my energies on my duties as president for the remainder of my term. My very first decision as the party nominee in 2020 was to pick Kamala Harris as my vice president, and it's been the best decision I've made. Today, I want to offer my full support and endorsement for Kamala to be the nominee of our party this year. Democrats, it's time to come together and beat Trump. Let's do this." Former President Barack Obama released a statement saying, "Joe has never backed down from a fight. For him to look at the political landscape and decide that he should pass the torch to a new nominee is surely one of the toughest in his life. But I know he wouldn't make this decision unless he believed it was right for America. It's a testament to Joe Biden's love of country and a historic example of a genuine public servant, once again putting the interests of the American people ahead of his own, that future generations of leaders will do well to follow." You can read his full letter here. Story developing. This next article is in Culture and News. Detroit keeps on having its moment. The Motor City's native daughter falls in love with her hometown all over again. The article is by Lucinda Scala Quinn. "It's a thrill to be back in the Motor City to celebrate a much-anticipated moment in Detroit's illustrious, if complicated, history. The newly reopened, modernized, futurized Michigan Central Station. The once iconic 1913 Beaux-Arts train terminal at its peak moved 4,000 souls in and out of its doors every day, and in so doing, cemented the music and ingenuity for which Detroit became famous. Once the crown jewel of Detroit's City Beautiful movement, which combined philosophy and architecture into a powerful urban planning ideology in North America during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, its closure in 1988 became the most powerful symbol of the city's decline toward the end of the past century. Its typical fashion, though, Detroiters turned urban decay into art, reimagining the location for graffiti art and as a backdrop for innovative house music and avant-garde performance. Today, thanks to the visionary William Clay Ford Jr., executive chair of the Ford Motor Company, more than 3,000 artisans brought the station back to its original glory, including the recreation and reinstallation of some 29,000 Guastavino tiles in a painstaking 6-year restoration project. Today, the country and proud city has reclaimed one of its most prized cultural institutions, which serves as part innovation laboratory, part museum, and part urban art gallery. To this native daughter, the city's vibrancy I'd once known in my bones 6 decades ago is back for every visitor to experience. I was born in South Detroit in 1959 and raised across the mighty Detroit River, one of the world's busiest international waterways and a vital socioeconomic pipeline. As far back as I can remember, every Sunday we would pass through the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel on our weekly trip to my grandparents for dinner out in Tecumseh, Essex County. Forever etched in my mind are the tunnel's fading yellow tiles, a backdrop to the sounds of sibling squabbles as we vied for precious real estate in the backseat of our woody station wagon. One fateful Sunday crossing in July 1967, as the race riots broke, a terrifying drama unfolded for all Detroiters, one that has infiltrated my dreams ever since. The image of tanks on the streets and snipers on building tops is a hard memory to override. By the time we headed east, an indelible divide had formed between the tree-lined white suburbs and the once vibrant downtown metropolis, seemingly overnight. That is, until the city's miraculous comeback after declaring bankruptcy a decade ago. Following the riots and a move to New York City, my infrequent visits back home seemed tainted. In the late 70s, with the building of a complex of skyscrapers owned and used by General Motors, known as Renaissance Center, came the promise of revitalization. But the cherished Detroit of my childhood, the Thanksgiving parade downtown at Hudson's, Greek town festivals, and swimming at the Detroit Yacht Club on Belle Isle, felt like a distant memory amid the ongoing civic strife. Years later, the security of this visitor still felt a bit shaky. The carefree little me vibe never quite recaptured until recently. In an even more distant past were my mom Rose's beloved memories of her glory days while attending the historic Detroit Society of Arts and Crafts, now called College for Creative Studies, in the 1940s, swinging at the Paradise Theater on Woodward Avenue to the live performances of Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. Today, a visit to the revitalized, cultural, diverse Detroit feels as welcoming as, or perhaps even more than, most American cities right now. Along with the restoration of Roosevelt Park along the Detroit River, nestled between local neighborhoods of Corktown, so called for its many original Irish immigrants from County Cork, Ireland, and Mexican Town, in the heart of southwest Detroit, is a dizzying array of outdoor activities and art installations available to residents and visitors. Other must-sees include the famous Diego Rivera murals at the Detroit Institute of Arts and the Motown Museum, which preserves the legacy of the pioneering record label, artists, and music of Detroit. The historic Greenfield Village is a fascinating museum, made up of about 100 buildings on a 200-acre campus, primarily dedicated to all of Henry Ford's innovations. Whether you're traveling to the Midwest for summer holidays, dropping off a college co-ed, or passing through on a road trip coast to coast along Route 80, you'll find Detroit is an American treasure reborn. Still in culture and news, actress Shannen Doherty has died at age 53. The star of 90210 was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2015. This article is by Katie Balby. Actress Shannen Doherty has died after a nearly decade-long battle with breast cancer. According to People, Doherty's publicist Leslie Sloan released a statement confirming the news. She said, "It is with a heavy heart that I confirm the passing of actress Shannen Doherty. On Saturday, July 13, she lost her battle with cancer after many years of fighting the disease. The devoted daughter, sister, aunt, and friend was surrounded by her loved ones, as well as her dog, Bowie. The family asks for their privacy at this time so they can grieve in peace." The Tennessee native began acting as a child in Father Murphy and Little House on the Prairie. She later gained fame with roles in Heathers, Beverly Hills 90210, Charmed, and more. Doherty was first diagnosed with breast cancer in 2015. After going into remission, her cancer returned in 2019. In 2023, she shared on Instagram that she had undergone surgery after the cancer had spread to her brain. "Our hearts go out to Doherty's family and friends during this difficult time." Here's an audiobook recommendation, The Horse by Willie Vlautin. That's V-L-A-U-T-I-N. The opening of this novel about a touring musician's life on the road finds 67-year-old Al Ward living in a lonely shack on abandoned mining claim, spending his days drinking tequila and playing guitar, running through the scores of songs he's written over the years, bringing up memories of wives, lives, bands, and alcohol-fueled tragedies gone by. When a blind horse appears in front of his cabin in even worse shape than he is, Al's frozen heart begins to melt, movingly narrated by the author. It's $21 at Amazon and $27 at bookshop.org if you're interested. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.